EU Confidential gets started right after this.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Russian missiles have crossed the border into Poland.
The Polish authorities have come out and said it's a Russian-made missile, but of course, it doesn't necessarily mean it was fired by Russia.
This explosion was most likely the result of a Ukrainian air defense missile that unfortunately landed in Poland.
This week, the war in Ukraine took a new and potentially dangerous turn. On Tuesday, a missile landed in Poland near the Ukrainian border, killing two people. It was the first incident on the soil of an EU and NATO member country since the war began. At the same time, leaders were meeting on the other side of the world for the G20 summit in Bali, where the news overshadowed the gathering, dominating discussion and debate. We must act. I'm Suzanne Lynch, Politico's chief Brussels correspondent. This week on EU Confidential, we'll analyse the latest developments in Russia's war in Ukraine and how the news of that attack in Poland was received in Bali. Later in the podcast, we'll hear from Hungarian author Susanna Szelenyi about her new book on Hungary's leader, Viktor Orban.
When the political language within a community, within a party, for example, or in a country is changing, and minority opinions are not acceptable, and political rivals are looked at enemies, these are the first warning signs.
But first, to the topic that has been dominating international discussion since February, the war in Ukraine.
Let me be clear. This is not Ukraine's fault. Russia bears ultimate responsibility as it continues its illegal war against Ukraine.
That's Jens Stoltenberg, Secretary General of NATO, speaking after an emergency meeting of NATO ambassadors on Wednesday in Brussels, which was called in the wake of the missile strikes. I'm joined by Politico's Jan Chinsky to bring us up to speed on where things stand with this story. Jan, what do we know so far about what transpired this week in Poland?
Well, there was a missile hit in eastern Poland, a village about 6 kilometres from the Ukrainian border, killing two people. The Polish government was very cautious. People were jumping to conclusions that it was a Russian rocket that hit Poland intentionally or unintentionally. The government was quite careful. For several hours, there was sort of silence as they tried to figure out what happened. And the conclusion now is that it was almost certainly a Ukrainian air defense missile. One, perhaps two. The Russians had launched the largest series of missile attacks on targets across Ukraine, I think in revenge for the retaking of Kherson. And so there's power blackouts and outages across Ukraine. And the Ukrainians were trying to knock down as many of these cruise missiles as possible. And what seems to have happened is that the air defense missile went astray and landed in Poland. These missiles are supposed to have auto-destruct, that they blow themselves up if they've missed their target. So there was just a bad series of events that led to this. It's clear that the Ukrainians, in a sense, had hoped that this would be a Russian missile. And when the first news came out, the Ukrainian government was saying, well, this is a sign that we need to get upgraded equipment, air defenses, perhaps F-15, F-16 fighters from the Americans to defend our airspace. Those calls have muted. The Ukrainians are still continuing to call for an investigation because they still haven't fully accepted that it was a Ukrainian air defense missile.
Yeah, that's been interesting that we've heard this language coming from President Zelensky. And what was so interesting, when the news broke first, we had this kind of blackout period, if you like, where people were wondering what happened next. And then we'll hear from Stuart later in the podcast about how things went down in Bali, where the G20 summit is happening. I mean, Jan, you know Poland, you're spending a lot of time there. I remember at the beginning of this war, there was a lot of talk, a lot of fear about a spillover effect into Poland, into these bordering countries. I mean, in a way, this encapsulated those deep fears when this happened. I mean, two people have lost their lives this week.
Yeah, the striking thing with this, and there's an understandable Ukrainian frustration about this, is the rest of the world seems to have sort of internalized that it's entirely normal for a country like Ukraine to be bombarded with rockets, missiles, have people killed in the streets. But a single rocket lands in Poland, EU, NATO territory, and the world stops. It's like, oh my God, are we heading towards World War III? What's going on? So for the Ukrainians, it's dramatically unfair. There's no... You can see that Poland is an entirely different category of country than Ukraine because of its membership in the European Union, especially in NATO.
But, I mean, they have legitimate concerns, as this incident really highlighted, that they are right beside this war. It's literally on their doorstep. So Poland has been arguing that this could have happened for the last few months. So one can understand why there has been that fear in Warsaw.
Yeah, but again, the Polish government was remarkably cautious because the stakes are very, very high. So they wanted to get this one right. And in the end, the call was correct. So there's no Article 5. There's no sort of call for a broader reaction on the part of its NATO allies. Russian propagandists have long been calling for Russia to start hitting roads, bridges, that sort of thing, to stop the flow of arms. There's a Polish airport in eastern Poland in a city called Rzeszów, which is a huge airport right now where the Americans and other allies are funneling vast amounts of military aid through there and on trucks and trains into Ukraine. So the Russians there's been pressure among the sort of nationalist pro-war right in Russia to start hitting these targets. So the Poles are quite fearful that this was going to happen. Hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. Jan, thank you very much for that. And we're going to go to Ukraine now, where Jamie Detmer, our colleague, has arrived this week and reporting there. Hi, Jamie.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. How are you? More to the point. I mean, what is the feeling there on the ground in Ukraine? Obviously, it's been a dramatic few days. Not only did we have the missiles in Poland, but also a barrage of missiles and attacks on Ukraine this week.
Well, it was the biggest barrage of attacks targeting the energy infrastructure of the country by Russia since October the 10th, and arguably bigger than October the 10th. There's a slight dispute about the number of missiles. Some officials are saying 90, others are saying 100. On October the 10th, it was 85. Now, the good news is they managed to intercept 70 of these missiles, but many towns were affected. Lviv was where I am now, was without electricity most of today. They've just come on the lights now. They've managed to patch it together again. Chernobyl, a town quite close to here, was also without electricity. Parts of Kiev. The list goes on. About 15 infrastructure facilities were hit and caused major chaos. One thing a lot of the commentators have missed, of course, is it wasn't just that towns and villages cast into darkness and into the cold, but also the railway system came to a grinding halt. I was meant to be travelling last night on a train from Poland into Ukraine. We waited for hours. The train didn't arrive. We had no information. In the end, we walked across the border early this morning at dawn and catch rides into Lviv. So the railway system was totally disrupted, leaving lots of Ukrainians across the country trying to get into the country and out stranded.
Yeah, what a picture. I mean, that reality of these strikes hitting infrastructure and the most fundamental parts of life in Ukraine. In terms, Jamie, of the development about the missiles landing in Poland, we've now been hearing from Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, saying really that this was non-intentional and that they now believe it's Ukrainian defence system, that's where this whole issue originated. What's been the response in Ukraine to this?
Well, the officials want to be part of the investigation to analyze the remnants of this missile. At the moment, it's going to be investigated by the US and the Poles. There's a certain amount of defensiveness about the Ukrainians in their reaction, because I think they're worried that in the end they'll get blamed. And the point that they're making, even if it was one of their missiles which was trying to intercept a Russian missile, is ultimately the responsibility for this rests with the Russians, because they were trying to shoot down Russian missiles attacking their energy infrastructure. They're trying to defend themselves. And the Italian foreign minister also made that point, that in the end, the ultimate blame, whoever missile it was, rests with the Russians. They're the ones who launched a war, an unprovoked war on Ukraine. That's the position of the Ukrainian officials, but they do want to be part of this investigation.
And Stoltenberg made that point too, you know, was careful to say that this is ultimately lies at the door of Russia. Jamie, thanks so much. We will be speaking to you over the next few weeks. Stay safe out there.
Thanks very much. Pleasure being on. Thanks.
As I mentioned, I spoke to Stuart Lau, our EU-China correspondent, earlier this week, who's been covering the G20 summit in Bali. Hi there, Stuart.
Hello, Suzanne.
So, look, this news broke in the early hours of Wednesday morning in Indonesia while leaders were sleeping. I mean, what has been the reaction there?
So the reaction was obviously, well, initially a shock to most of the leaders present here. So Rishi Sunak got woken up by his staff at 5 a.m., for example, telling him what's going on. And then he had a phone call with the foreign secretary and the defense secretary, of course. And then soon enough, there was a mini NATO meeting, if you like, taking place right here in the tropical resort. Joe Biden, the US president, was convening the meeting. The other NATO heads of state in G20 were also present, except, interestingly, the Turkish president. But otherwise, all the Europeans are there. They were obviously very concerned about the situation. So the line really was about making sure that there would be a thorough investigation by the Polish authorities about who fired the missile, the million-dollar question. And US President Biden was also talking about the trajectory unlikely being from Russia. And that was quite early on during the day, actually. So that gave rise to a lot of speculation about what he meant by that, what preliminary evidence he's got, but he didn't really elaborate on that, nor did the European leaders.
Mm-hmm. So that, in a sense, those early comments by Biden when we woke up in Europe here calmed nerves. And you're referring there earlier to Rishi Sunak, obviously the British Prime Minister, his first big meeting at a platform like this, a G7 or a G20. So, I mean, as the day went on then, I mean, looking more generally then, I mean, the leaders of the G20 did manage to sign up to a communique with language on the war in Ukraine.
Yeah, they did. And obviously, the Europeans took it as a big victory. Emmanuel Macron, the French president, was giving a press conference just a moment ago. And he also, you know, placed a lot of emphasis on the fact that there could be a communique. The Indians, for that matter, played a big role here as well, because they will be the G20 host next year. And obviously, they don't want to see a scenario where there will be no communique and that becomes a sort of general practice, if you like. So obviously, they did a lot to try to mediate, to get, you know, not just the Chinese, but actually the Russians to say yes to such a communique. So the trick really here is that, you know, according to Western officials, is about making sure that there are enough mentions in the communique about each nation having their own position, for example, before they went on to cite the UN resolution, which of course condemns Russian war of aggression. So I think, you know, by making sure that there is room for everyone to interpret their own version, their own story, even with this communique in place, I think that was the trick to securing such an outcome.
Yeah, I mean, we'd heard in the run-up there'd been lots of discussions among officials, among Sherpas, as they're known, to try and get this language over the line, because you had these different views and a lot of countries not wanting to take sides, as they see it, on the Russia-Ukraine war. One issue or one theme I suppose a lot of our listeners will be interested in is the EU side of things. I was writing last week about the tense relationship between Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, and Charles Michel, the president of the European Council. We had heard that there was potentially a meeting between Michel and Xi, and would von der Leyen be invited to that? In the end, that didn't happen. What were relations like between the two? I mean, I saw one photograph of them with the other leaders, and they were sitting miles apart from each other. So how did things go for them in Bali?
I think I was the culprit for that photo that you were just mentioning, but obviously, you know, this was so funny in a way, you know, looking at the big screen, you know, obviously the cameraman or woman was trying to portray, you know, okay, guys, this is the two EU presidents sitting side by side, but obviously they were sitting like very far apart, especially, you know, the impact was quite funny on a big screen because, you know, that distance sort of got exaggerated a little bit. So the two presidents did manage to sit together for an Australia dialogue just today. So it was an EU-Australia thing. So obviously the two of them were present together. But as you were pointing out, initially it was the plan for the European Council President Charles Michel to have a one-on-one meeting with President Xi. That didn't go through. So the EU side, you know, privately they're saying, you know, we obviously, you know, everything is in flux in a situation like this. You know, it's G20, so everyone got a lot of plans, not to mention the fact that there was this, you know, Poland incident in the morning. But obviously, you know, China was also very upset about what Charles Michel was trying to say just a week or so ago in a pre-recorded message that was supposed to be aired in a Shanghai Trade Expo. He recorded a message, the Chinese listened to it. Obviously, he said something about the Russian war and aggression, and that was not comfortable to Chinese ears, so they decided to pull off the speech. And since then, I think, you know, the EU side started realizing that maybe this meeting in Bali would never happen.
Yeah, and of course, there was a potential meeting between Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, and Xi. That didn't happen either. I mean, that brings us on to one of the big themes of this G20, and that was the role of China. Big moment for Xi Jinping on the global stage. How did things go from a Chinese perspective? I mean, Stuart, you are a China correspondent. You write about this relationship and China quite a lot. I mean, how did things go down for them?
So obviously the highlight was the meeting between the US and Chinese presidents, Biden and Xi. It lasted 3.5 hours long. And I think what's really striking for a lot of commentators is that this time around, the tone is really much softer than before. The level of contention or the level of, you know, contentiousness really decreases quite a bit in the sense that Biden is talking also about cooperation and all that. Of course, you know, you have the Chinese readouts, which focus more on the Chinese version of stories, you know, how the Chinese see the issue of Taiwan, for example, warning the Americans not to overstep the red lines and so on. But I think overall, there was an intention for both sides to reestablish the ties, to not resetting the tone, but at least, you know, to try to bring the relationship back from the brink of collapse or the brink of conflict. I think that was a very clear message. In terms of Xi Jinping-Europe relations, we talked about Michel not getting the meeting. On the other hand, Xi Jinping has been very active in reaching out to member states, you know, for one-on-one bilaterals. So you have Macron, you have Mark Rutte, the Dutch Prime Minister, you have Sanchez, the Spanish Prime Minister, and of course, just a few weeks ago, Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, who actually went to Beijing. So at this moment, you know, the feeling is that China is very keen to make sure that the big economies in the bloc would keep a positive relationship with China. And through that, China is hoping to bring, you know, the EU-China relations overall also on a more steady and predictable path.
Thanks again for joining us, Stuart.
Thanks, Suzanne.
Coming up, we'll hear from Zuzana Szalenyi about her new book, Tainted Democracy, Viktor Orban and the Subversion of Hungary. Stay with us.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Susanna Szalenyi first got to know Viktor Orban in the 1980s as Hungary was transitioning to a democracy and Orban's Fidesz party was emerging as a new political force. But Szalenyi, who's now at the CEU Democracy Institute in Budapest, quickly became one of his harshest critics. I spoke to her earlier this week about her book, Tainted Democracy, Viktor Orban and the Subversion of Hungary. Thank you very much for joining us, Susanna, on the podcast. Your book opens with an image of you standing next to Viktor Orban as he delivered a speech in 1989. And you're a founding member of the Fidesz movement, and you capture that sense of potential and excitement as the Cold War came to a close. And yet you became very disillusioned with Orban eventually, a very outspoken critic of his leadership. Tell us, though, a bit about your impressions of Orban back then, more than 30 years ago.
Okay, so first of all, a Fidesz party was established by a number of students who came out from specialized colleges. And this gave an opportunity for young people in the 80s to think about politics and democracy and exercise political rights within the colleges. So there was an experience of how to do politics. And this was a very specific environment. And early Fidesz was really a super open and very democratic organization. Viktor Orban was a decisive person. However, it was a community-led organization for several years. He was very smart and very strategic. He always wanted to be the first to comment on things and give his opinion. So somehow this urging, pressing presence, I think that was all already back then his personal quality, just something that we also see out of him today. But he had a good humor. He was actually a likable person in general.
So, I mean, why did you start moving away from Fidesz? Where did the disillusionment set in for you?
So Fidesz has started to change when we got into parliament in 1990. This was a very different status comparing to a movement. The atmosphere within the Fidesz parliamentary faction changed significantly in 1991-1992. It was very humiliating and bullying style. It was not good to represent a minority opinion. And of course, Orban was very strongly manipulating the opinion of the group. He was elected as party president in 1993, and from that point on, the centralization of resources and decision-making was very tangible.
Okay, within Orban himself, that centralization of power. I mean, one of the quotes I came across reading the book, it's from 2011, and it's language from Orban, where it really captures his feelings toward the EU. He says, in 1848, we could not be dictated to by Vienna. And in 1956, we would not be dictated to from Moscow. And now we will not be dictated to from Brussels or from anywhere. And you say that that was a kind of a moment for you where you decided to go back into politics for another party. But, you know, where do you or how do you explain the beginning of this kind of anti-EU sentiment by Orban?
I think something has seriously changed by 2010. Orban oftentimes explained that the world has changed, the West is on a decline. I think the 2008 economic crisis was a very important experience, and he felt that the dominance of the West is over, the new powers are coming up, good life is possible to be organized with other type of leadership than liberal democracy. And he made a significant shift in his mindset. He explained it in several speeches to his own people. And in 2010, when he got this landslide victory, he initiated a new foreign policy paradigm in Hungary, which was really against everything was consensual before in the first 20 years after the regime change. And he started this tightroping, balancing relationship between Western alliance and some Eastern powers, first with Russia and then very openly with China as well.
And so that shift towards authoritarianism that you described there, that gradual shift, what worries you
about what you've seen over the last few years in Hungary about these rule of law concerns. I mean, it's a big week here in Brussels in terms of the Commission preparing to take a decision on funding for Hungary. But what are the main concerns you have or worries you have about Hungarian democracy currently and over the last few years?
So Hungarian democracy went through a very radical change since 2010. Already in the first 1 year when Orbán's party made this landslide victory, the one-party government changed the constitution. They changed several dozens of cardinal laws, which basically structure the constitutional setup of a country, including media law, election law, and a lot of other things which shape the political scene. And all of these changes were favoring Fidesz party and were pushing down any alternative political forces like opposition parties or controlling forces like media or civil society organizations. And by 2014, when Orbán declared his state as an illiberal state, Hungary was really far away from what we regard liberal democracy. And the chances to change this party government in a democratic way was already seriously challenged. And the situation ever since is more difficult.
And of course, then we had the migration crisis starting then at the EU level, where we really saw Orbán taking this stance against Brussels at the time in terms of migration policy. Do you think the EU has handled Viktor Orbán the right way? I mean, has it been tough enough? Did it enable Orbán to some extent?
Well, I would say the member states, which create the political will of the EU, really mishandled Viktor Orbán and his maneuvering politics. They thought for many years that there was always a basic agreement from Orbán's side that to be in the EU is a critical issue for Hungary. And they always were looking for compromise and find some solution and just, you know, to make a least trouble for the EU. There was always some problem within the European Union, but I think they deeply underestimated the will of Orbán and how far he is ready to go beyond any kind of red lines. For example, the rule of law issues. I mean, the EU never made a systemic analysis on what is happening and what is the outcome of the changes, how it looks in holistically from Hungarian point of view. What is the landscape is looking at a certain point in the Hungarian political election. For example, the migration issue. I mean, this was such an incredible campaign. And Fidesz party always found the loopholes where the EU was working not by common legal decisions, by actually some kind of political agreements, you know, the same rules. He always tried to change the rule of the games in every field where it was not written.
I mean, a huge towering figure in EU politics during that decade was, of course, Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor. Yes. Do you put some of the blame at her door?
I think this whole attitude was coming very openly from the German Christian Democratic Party. I think there was within the EPP group several years heavy criticism towards Fidesz, and also there were some Eastern Europeans who were for Fidesz, and the balancing party, the biggest party there was the CDU, and until 2018, basically, no one questioned Fidesz's place in this political party. Yes, Angela Merkel's party was very, very protected for Viktor Orbán.
Yeah, that's the EPP, the European, the centre-right political grouping, the European People's Party in the European Parliament you're referring to there, and his membership of that for many years. Your book really documents the political career of Orbán. But what was also very interesting was the implications for the wider community, the wider world. At one point you write, no society in the world can confidently say it is immune to autocracy. And it struck me, I read recently a fantastic book, How Democracies Die, by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, which is a brilliant analysis, really, of Trumpism in America. But also this idea that, you know, democracies don't just die, you know, in one fell swoop, that actually it's a gradual process that can creep up. So, I mean, what do you think about the implications of a figure like Orbán for the wider world? And what kind of lessons are there for other established democracies that this move towards autocracy can happen?
Yeah, I think the first momentum, when the political language within a community, within a party, for example, or in a country is changing, and minority opinions are not acceptable, and rivals, political rivals, are looked at enemies, these are the first warning signs. For example, in Hungary, in Fidesz party, it started very, very early when Orbán's opinion was not supported someone. That person really had to see a lot of bullying and humiliation. But let's say in 2002, when Viktor Orbán lost elections after being the prime minister first, he gave a very strong speech in which he said basically that he represents the entire nation. The party is not in opposition because the nation is not in cannot be in opposition. And he was in opposition, so he basically delegitimized the winning political forces. He didn't question the result of the elections, like in many cases in Brazil and the US, we are seeing this now. But basically, he told his people, even though they are in opposition, they are the majority. They are the legitimate representative. So these are the big issues when you just deny, or one party denies, the right of another political force to be present, to express opinion and to lead. These are the very, very critical issues. And sometimes it goes through in a very, very subtle way.
Yeah. So this demonization of the opposition is one of those warning signs, as you say, which we see particularly in the United States at the moment. Look, we are sitting here talking about Viktor Orban, and yet he was reelected with a landslide victory back in April. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's important to say that it's approximately 30-35% of the voting population is satisfactory, according to the current Hungarian laws, that one party get the supermajority. So majority of people did not vote it to Viktor Orbán, but he doesn't need the majority because our election law is so incredibly distorted and favors Fidesz's party. The election rules were changed some 20 times in the last 12 years in Hungary. Basically, before every election, there are some slight modification which puzzle and often destroy opposition strategies. So there are a lot of legal conditions that it's very difficult to beat Viktor Orban's party in Hungary. The other thing is that the government really made a huge, huge vote buying before the elections. 6 months before the elections, some 4-5% of the Hungarian GDP was redistributed in a very targeted way to some social groups which were supposed to vote for Fidesz. So there was a huge outflowing from the Hungarian budget, and the current 20% inflation in Hungary is definitely partly the result of this overspending. The third thing was the extraordinary campaign machinery and media and campaign machinery which Fidesz party is having by now. And this was very important when the war broke out, the Russia's war against Ukraine broke out. That was just a couple of weeks before the Hungarian elections. And everyone thought that it's a big problem for Orban because he was so much a pro-Kremlin in previous years that many people thought that he cannot do this. And then they changed a significant part of public opinion, saying that they are on the side of peace and the opposition is a warmonger. Basically, Orban said people have to choose between blood or gas. But this is also part of how illiberalism works. You know, you don't need to put opposition politicians to prison. You just basically have to make their strategies impossible.
Susanna, thank you very much for joining us on EU Confidential.
Thank you very much for having me here.
We did reach out to Hungary's permanent representation to the EU here in Brussels and put to them Zeleny's criticisms. We didn't hear back at time of recording. And that's it for this week. I'm off next week, but you'll be in good hands with my colleague Sarah Wheaton in the hosting chair. If you haven't already, be sure to follow us wherever you're listening to our podcast. And you can always send us feedback and ideas by emailing us. The address is podcast@politico.eu. Thanks this week to our producer, Eve Streeter from Whistledown Productions, Ellen Boonen on recording and production, our editor, James Randerson, and our executive producer for audio, Christina Gonzalez. Thank you for listening.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.